The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
Welcome to Cartoon Fun. It's Cartoonerific. Yeah!
What's up, everybody? And welcome to the Cartoonerific Classic Animated Cartoon Podcast. And this is your host over here, Brian Mitchell.
Well, last week on the old podcast, we were talking with Mr. Scott O'Brien. He's an animator, producer, director, and he's done some real wonderful stuff, a lot of it for TV. But we were talking about his influences and where he grew up and his career in the Midwest, and then moving or making a decision to move to the West Coast for bigger and better things. And so that's where we kind of left off. We were talking a little bit about Lost in Space as well, which is a favorite of mine from my youth. And so anyway, we're going to continue on and get into the meat of his career. And so we're going to get right into it. So don't you go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Cartoonerific Podcast. Classic animated cartoons with your host animator, Brian Mitchell. And now it's time for our special Cartoonerific guest.
Well, like I promised, here is part two of our interview with Mr. Scott O'Brien. Please sit back and enjoy. So after you saw Jennifer Aniston on the airplane and Lost in Space, what happened? You got to Rhythm Muse. How did it go? Did they obviously, they couldn't really sit you down and have you start doing computer animation, right?
They trained me. So first of all, they were like, okay, I stayed with I did know one person out in LA, my friend Tim Kennard. Mm-hmm. I stayed with him for a couple weeks while I tried to figure out like where I was going to live and all that stuff in LA. Uh-huh. And at Rhythm Hughes, they had a whole group of people living at these apartments in Culver City called the Meadows. There was like, let's say like maybe 25 people that lived there in this complex.
Right.
From Rhythm and Hughes. I was like, all right, I went and I lived there. And mm-hmm. then I kind of came to like a core group of like, oh, look, I have these friends.
Right.
You know, and people who are like younger, like I was, which it wasn't that young. I was 27.
Right.
But you know, and then, yeah, Rhythm Hughes, they had a 2-month period where they trained me. That I might be wrong, I might have been longer. Hmm. But they trained me. They had this training area. So I had to learn Unix. I had to learn how CG works. I had to learn the pipeline of it. And, yeah, it was going to school. And it was, I mean, there's pictures of me. I have to dig it up, but boy, I'm sitting at that computer like, you can see it in my mind, I'm terrified, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is so out of my wheelhouse.
Right.
Because I've been, even when I was worked at register at the store, like, I had a hard time picking it up.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a technical person. So this was like, this is all this code. And you had to enter it in 1998, you had to enter in a lot of code.
Wow.
And just the learning curve was pretty tough. And even like, you know, because like, well, I was talking about animating, like I have a Sharpie and I would, you know, when I would do my regular animation, I'm in there, I'm going, you know,
right.
With CG at that point, like I'd move the mouse and I'd see the model, like I move the mouse again.
Kind of deconstruct.
I'm not in that shot, you know?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. It's really tough. When'd you find out that you were actually starting to understand it? A week ago. No. Right.
It took me, you know, because it was, there were so many things that could go wrong. Like there was like there were some people like I got in good with the commercial department, like because after Babe that was just like lip sync, but the commercial department liked me. Do you know Peggy Regan? Like she was in the commercial department then,
right?
And I met her, and they would have me do stuff like Listerine bottles and all these other kind of things. And I enjoyed that a little bit more. But if like say like there was one thing where one of this grocery store's name out there was Lucky, they're out of business.
Right.
But they had this card with a face on, walk around, mm-hmm. and like almost like a Fleischer thing. There's one time they're like, all right, just have this thing walking through for the temp for this shot, and we'll get this out this weekend. And I went to animate that, and my arms are growing, and I couldn't do it. I was working so hard. I couldn't do it. And right. it was just a disaster. And then I found out later that when somebody else went in there to fix it, because, boy, if you feel like a failure, like it's just a little card. Someone went in there later, like, oh, yeah, they had somewhat – the person who had used that rig before had customized it specifically for another scene, so things weren't working right.
Right.
So when I would move an arm, it was like,
right, like it stretched
away, like, what the hell happened? Right. And I didn't have the knowledge in me to even know that it wasn't something that I was doing wrong, that the rig was, you know, it was just so much.
Right.
You know?
Right. That, yeah, so, stuff like that happens. And how are you supposed to know?
I know.
Yeah. Because, I can imagine myself being in that situation, being like, they're going to fire me, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. You yeah. feel that anxiety.
Yeah.
And yeah, within early on, like within, by the time it was like I started in February or March, but by the time it was June, like, I'm losing my mind. Like I'm going to go, I need to animate I need to do something that I enjoy. So that's when I went looking for, I was like, okay, I'm going to search out this guy, Daryl Van Sitters, this guy who I thought was doing the best stuff. Because actually, the impact, what I was talking about before, when like seeing that Bugs Bunny magazine and seeing his Box Office Bunny and the other stuff, like seeing the commercial and the opening of the Bugs Bunny and Tweety show.
Right.
Because before that, through the 80s, I'm sure you remember this, like through the 70s and early 80s, like those were dead characters. Like they were... Mm-hmm. They were destroyed. Like no one could do Bugs Bunny, and I had no idea that Fritz Freleng was still doing it. You know, but it was like you heard that voice, like, oh, yippee! Like it's Bugs, but it's like old Mel Blanc. You know,
right?
It's like, holy cow, these characters are dead.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I saw Daryl's stuff where it's like, oh, here's someone who gets it. Look at this, you know. Here's someone who cares. I couldn't believe that Bugs Bunny had come back.
Well, I think he had Jeff Bergman doing the voice of Bugs at that point.
Yep.
And Mel died in the late 80s, I guess. He died right before Box Office Bunny or something. But, you know,
even the way Bugs was handled, like, he had this thick muzzle, and he was very, I mean, he was very stiff, like.
Right.
They didn't want to animate that guy, you know?
No, and definitely, I think what you're saying about Mel's performance, because it was kind of, you know, he's kind of, hello, Doc, you know, it's like it's not the up Bugs Bunny, you know, where what's up, Doc? You know, it's, you know, kind of low and gravelly, you know?
It's also complicated by the fact that they'd have all these specials they would show on TV, and in the specials, they... asininely cut it together where it would be like the old stuff, it's all snappy and good,
right
next to the new stuff, and boy, you could instantly, you heard a difference in the music and in their voices, like,
yeah,
you know. And I think also, as I found out later, like it seemed like also Mel, like it seemed like they had sped up his voice in Bugs Bunny, and mm-hmm. And now, I mean, in the 80s, they were just using his voice. So I think that could have, like, been complicating the issue, from what I could guess.
I think so. But I think, you know, like I said, I think with, like when he did Sylvester, that was probably very close to Mel's actual voice.
Yeah.
And when they did Daffy, they sped it. And the same thing with Porky Pig. They sped it up. With Bugs, I think he could just do it. I don't think they needed to do any alteration, but maybe later on they had to. They had to say, you know.
I'm not sure. But either way, like I had Daryl's stuff had really stood out to me. So when I came out to LA, I was like, all right, this is the guy I want to contact. This one studio.
Right.
I really want to contact.
And that was Renegade.
It was Renegade.
Yeah.
And I Renegade studio. Went over there. There's this Daryl there alone at the time. There was like a little building. It was like behind Tony Roma's.
In Glendale, right?
Yeah. This was in Burbank. They didn't move to Glendale yet.
Oh, okay.
So this was in Burbank. They were like a little place with like Daryl's office. There's a room where the pencil tests and the animators were. And then there was like another room with the editing bay. And then where Ashley's, it's four rooms.
Right.
Good little place.
Yeah.
And I went there and he's like, yeah, I have something for you. You know? And he gave me the first shot of this, you know, Chester Cheetah commercial.
Wow.
I was like, oh, you know, I did it. And then I worked my heart out, brought it in expecting, all right, this is a real big time, right?
This is it.
I showed it to him. You know, and I pencil tested there. And he goes, good. You want another one? You know, so I was like, oh my God, no notes. You know?
Right.
Like, it was great. It was great. Like, God, this was what I was looking for. Like, at the frustration of CG at the time and going there and doing what I loved and just getting, it was like, God, really kind of showed, like, all right, well, this, I obviously belong at this here, doing this, you know?
Yeah. I love hand-drawn animation. I love the crafting of that. Yeah. And I like the pencil and paper and flipping, you know?
Yep.
I know I've worked on Cintiq. I still like the pencil and paper. It just feels more organic to me. But I understand the value of Cintiq. And
I said this before too on another thing where when I was using Toon Boom for the first time, which was like I was doing some Harley Quinn opening titles. It was the first time I had used it. I learned it pretty fast. I was using this pencil tool doing it in red.
Right.
And I was like, wow, this really feels like this really feels like 2D. And then I was just going and going and flipping and going. And at the end, I had that, like, I was surprised to not have graphite on my hand.
Yeah.
Like, it got that close to like how that true feeling I used to have, where it's like, whoa, you know, it's back. You know, it felt amazing.
Yeah.
So,
wow. So how long did you stay at Renegade? It was basically freelance. And then did you come in house on?
It was basically freelance. I was doing these things at Rhythm and Hues, like these projects would come up, but they were all very technical.
Right.
And this one thing that finally kind of broke me was like this movie, Along Came a Spider, where it's a car crash. And the car had all this stuff, like it went on the bridge was on the computer, and this car had all these engine parts and stuff. And it was so heavy, and you had to turn off all these things with this code to get it. So even if a car is like this kind of car is easy to do in CG, but it's like I had all these extra things to make it very heavy. And it was like exactly what I was saying before. Like you move the mouse and you had to go in there and technically turn off all these different things. And there's like people inside.
Right.
And that, like, I gotten to a certain point, but the guy who was directing it kept going in there and was like adjusting something, the technical things. But I was so overwhelmed, like handling this, all this stuff, all these different things in there that was like, I didn't even realize it. I was like, you know, I got to get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
And that's when I was really, that's when Daryl and Ashley, they got more work at Renegade. And they're like, you want to come full time? You'll be our only animator. I was like, yes. And then Rhythm and Hues got Cats and Dogs.
Right.
Like Cats and Dogs. And they had these ninja cats. They were very excited. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, we got this job. And I said, I quit. And the line producer at the time, this woman, I can't remember her name. She was like, oh yeah, good luck in 2D. It's dead. Like, so then I was at Renegade. And God, those years, I was on top of the world. Like, I loved it. I loved it there.
Right.
And that was probably like around 2000 or so.
You must have worked with Howie Perry over there.
Yeah. He started, that was later. That's when they moved. That's what you remember.
Yeah, because I visited him over there. And he trained with me when he was in New York. He actually took classes with me for a while.
So, yeah, he's a good guy. Like, he's actually, he's one of my best friends. He's like the godfather of my son, actually. Well, I mean, like, he's a great friend.
Yeah, cool. Cool.
Yeah, that was actually quite a bit later than Renegade had opened up their, they wanted to get into TV, and then we did these two pilots. We did a pilot for Captain Sturdy, this first one. Mm-hmm. Cartoon Network didn't pick it up, but then he wanted to do another pilot. And this one, we were still a small studio where I was then I was doing layout. We had freelance animators. And then they didn't do the other pilot. They didn't pick up the other pilot. Then we got the Pepeyami Yumi pilot. And Daryl was like, I guarantee they're going to pick this one up. I was like, this is like a nothing little thing that we're doing. He's like, no way. Like, this is like the one that Sam Register wanted to do. He came to us with it. Mm-hmm. And we did it pretty fast. Giamo did the backgrounds. I'm kind of getting a little ahead of myself. Where I'm getting beyond the Lost in Space stuff.
Well, let's talk about Lost in Space a little bit. How did Lost in you did this little pilot thing, which blew my socks off when I first saw it. And then kind of like a couple of years later, I was like, gee, I wonder what happened to that Lost in Space thing. I wonder if that's still up. And it was on YouTube. And I pulled it up. And it's still great. I'm like, and what this is was this was a little pilot thing that you did, which utilized the soundtrack of the actual show, but you just put it in cell animation. And I thought it was terrific. I mean, I actually posted it on the Cartoonerific page. So if anybody,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I shared it on there because I just thought it was so great. And that was the thing that I wanted to contact you about, find out what actually happened with that. So how does that come in the scheme? Were you Rhythm and Use when this happened? And and was this the burning thing that you wanted to do a 2D thing and here was Lost in Space? Tell us a little bit about that. Because if you haven't seen it, it's on YouTube. Go to it. But if you go to the Cartoonerific Facebook page, it's posted on there too. You can find it. So, but anyway, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I was obsessed with Lost in Space, you know. And I had, when I come out to LA, I had seen the movie, and I hated it. Like, the movie came out, and I felt they blew it on so many levels, right? Like, these aren't the characters I know. Like, why are they making it look like this? Like part of what made it approachable was that, when I was a kid, was that they're in a house. It's like the size of a house,
right?
You know,
they got the garden.
Yeah, right? They have the garden. Yeah, they have everything, and including I grew up in, like I said, Chicago, and then we had a picture window. My dad had a hi-fi stereo under there. Uh-huh. I pulled up the chairs during the night when it's pitch black out. I open up that hi-fi, turn on those lights, like. I was on the Jupiter 2, and there was like a dining room table behind me, which was like the Astrogator. Like, it was like the feeling was like, this is it. Like, it felt so relatable. And I felt they blew it in the movie where it's like, they're in, that might as well be a shopping mall. Like, what's the layout in there? Like,
right.
And they're in like this, whatever, Matrix style costumes.
Whoever designed the robot and the Jupiter 2, the spaceship. And the, what did they call it? The rover? Was it
the chariot?
The chariot.
In the show? Yeah, the chariot.
The chariot, which was basically their car. And I don't understand how they fit that into the Jupiter 2, you know, but anyway.
Oh, whatever.
Yeah. But as a kid watching this stuff, I thought it was really cool. I thought there was so much great things about that show. I absolutely loved it. So there we go.
I also thought even little things where the spaceship's flying and you see behind them like the little version of the spaceship inside the glass, like an astrogator.
Yeah.
Like you see that thing kind of tilting with their ship.
You know?
Like, oh, this is cool.
And they even had like a space pack, didn't they? Where they put it on their back and they could, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, Dad.
Which was actually a thing that they had at Disneyland. They had somebody in this jetpack.
Yeah.
They would demonstrate it. But this was 10 years after the fact.
Loud as hell, what I heard.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a rocket. So, so you saw this thing and you were kind of angry and motivated at the same time.
Right. So I started like on one of those, you know, one of my notebooks, I started like thumbing out like, oh boy, it should have been this. And I started coming up with an idea that was like the Lost in Space idea.
Mm-hmm.
I did a little bit of storyboarding before that, but not much. So there's a definite learning curve there where it was like, all right, how do I make it look like I want it to look? You know, because I knew what I wanted to look like. And I felt like the action cartoons of the day, Batman the Animated Series, I thought was great, but
right.
I thought there was a way to do it where it was even more like how early H&B did limited animation, right? Like how they did with Johnny Quest, how the Flintstones had done. There's something cool about it.
Right.
And style, like what they were doing with limited animation with like the Tex Avery did with Symphony of Slang,
right.
Right. Like great, those great kind short. Of designs.
Yeah.
And then I was keeping all that in mind, trying to come together with something. I came up with this idea that was, you know, it's pretty much what ended up my short. And then I was like, oh, I need people to record the voices. And I brought in just one friend, and it became apparent immediately that, oh man, I need real actors. This is going to make it suck.
Yeah.
And I was like, but these guys here, my thing, they're saying enough. It's love. They're saying a lot. The rough dialogue was Lost in Space type stuff. Like, I bet you I can find stuff that is pretty close to what I need. That the problem is going to be that there's music and stuff in there, but I mean, and I had 5 episodes of Lost in Space on video, plus Kevin Burns, Lost in Space Forever special on DVD.
Okay.
So I went in there and it was on cassette. I don't even think it was on computer, where I grabbed every audio which I possibly could use. And I had all these lines, like I had like Judy and all these lines that she could say, or Will, all these lines that they could say, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to my thing and it's like, okay, now I need a computer. I got a Mac, a G4 or something, like it was a new Mac at the time.
Right.
And okay, this has editing software. And I mean, it was the obsession again, the obsession side of me again, where it's like, hey, I took all that dialogue and I can make this work. I can make this. And if I could get a radio play, then I know that I could adjust my visuals to match it. I got this thing together and I put the music in there and I was like, that sounds like an episode to me.
Right.
All right. You know, and then I boarded it and I put it all together and I had an animatic there. I was like, and then, you know, of course, I had to adjust it a bit as I went along, but then I was like, no, no, this feels like it. This feels like it.
Right.
And, you know, I started to get, you know, started to feel, you know, get pretty amped, like, all right, here we go, you know?
Right.
Not thinking, like, what am I going to do after that? Where's it going to go? I didn't care.
Right.
I was just making this because it felt like, I don't know, like, you know, with that history of mine of like wanting to make the robot when I was little or wanting to do it in junior high, like that feeling just came by where this is just for me. I'm doing this for me. And if I don't have enough 2D work coming in with Daryl, because he only had it like once in a while,
right,
I guess work on this. And that will ease my bug to work on it.
Right. Know? Wow.
So.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And yeah, designs wise, it was like, you know, some were like a little bit like I pretty much ripped off Will Finn's, the guy from Little Mermaid for Dr. Smith. I figured, yeah, no one's going to see it anyway. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Will was kind of based off that. I had all these, by that time I learned who Tom Orb was. I couldn't believe that. Oh my God. This one guy like was my, like influenced almost all my favorite designs.
Sure.
And at that point I'd worked at Daryl's a lot, and there's sometimes I was there alone, and he had all these commercials from the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, and at that point I had a girlfriend who like worked until midnight. She worked until late at Rhythm and Hues.
Right.
So I would have like nothing to do. So I had plenty of time. So I would watch these commercials, and there's one where it blew me away immediately and made my eyes kind of go crazy, where it was a Pepsodent girl.
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, this girl comes out to, like, and you see her dress, like, and these guys come out, Susie Q. I found out later it was MGM. It was those MGM guys, the
right.
Freelance.
There you go.
Like, it moves like Tom and Jerry, but I thought the animation, it's on ones, her dress like flowing.
Yeah.
For Pepsodent. And yeah, I pretty much ripped that off for Penny's design of the girl with the ponytail.
Mm-hmm.
And Will was, he was just like a typical kid that I would like to draw, or, you know, like a Calabash Yuck Lucky Charms kid, except I mean, I'm a little more round face. Like, at that point, I was watching a lot of the Disney Boy and a Horse. What was it called?
Cowboy Needs a Horse.
Cowboy Hit Needs a Horse.
It was Bill Justice like short. That. Bill mm-hmm. Justice, mm-hmm. Yeah. Great short.
And also, like, when I would think about, even though it was just for me, I would think about what am I going to do in the future with this? If I had a future, because I could picture, like, all these things. Like, I want it to be like Toot Whistle Punk and Boom sometimes. I love that kind of stuff. I want it. I
yeah.
was looking. Daryl also had he had Magic Highway USA.
Yeah, Ward like, Kimball.
Ooh, this is awesome. This is awesome. Like that kind of tech and the kind of Bee Gees.
Right.
And Mars and Beyond.
Yep.
Where like these, you know, Ivan Earl backgrounds.
Yeah.
Right, I want these Ivan Earl type backgrounds. This is what I want. This is what I want. And yeah, I guess I just kept on. Yeah, I was on fire with it. I was getting very excited.
Sure. You know? Sure. You're naming all the stuff that I really love, by the way.
Oh, am I?
No, I know you are. Well, that's why I know it all. You know, it's funny because I taught at the Disney Institute in Florida when there was a Disney Institute back in the, I think it was 2000, 2001. Uh-huh. And one of the nights they always had like somebody coming in to speak, because it was a real animation event. They would screen some films and then they would have somebody talk about it. And, you know, Eric Goldberg was there and none of the old timers. It was all like, you know, Lilo and Stitch and stuff. So they had, you know, the key people from that
right.
on stage when they presented the movie. And, but one night they presented Melody, which,
oh yeah. Have you ever seen that in 3D?
I didn't see it in 3D, but they showed Melody and I saw it years ago, but I saw it on the big screen for the first time where they actually had the print.
Yeah.
And so they didn't show it in 3D. I heard the 3D version is excellent, but they showed that, and it was beautiful, beautiful print. So I was glad that they did that. But all that Ward Kimball stuff. I actually met Ward Kimball years ago, and I have
He seems cool.
He was very cool, and when I went to his house, and I spent about 5 hours there. And so he's showing me his backyard train. He had a full-size train in his backyard, but he had these toy rooms, and he had kinetic sculptures that he had done, and God, you know, it was wonderful. I have some pictures that I should post on my website, but he was brilliant, and he did all that stuff you're talking about, Magic Highway USA. He was directing that, and the Man the Moon, and then Mars and Beyond, and all that stuff is on Disney Channel. You can actually watch it, which I thought it would never make Disney Channel, but it's historical stuff, and it's a great. It's all limited animation, so it's crazy stuff, but wonderful.
Yeah, it's really inspiring, and it kind of shows like what you could do with like just well planned motion. It's just so effective and strong, you know. It's really cool.
Yeah. Really cool. Well, clearly he was Kimball was just a guy that he was trying to do things differently. Just because I think he was bored. I think he was bored by, because when you animate, a lot of the stuff is the same, you know? A lot of the stuff you're doing is the same. A lot of times you're repeating yourself because you know things work and you kind of use it. But here he was actually being inventive and he was trying to be funny too. He's trying to, you know, use his sense of humor. And those things are really, really fun. So
yeah the motion is really, it's cool. It feels, for whatever reason, it feels very expensive to me, like there's something cool about like something held and you have something else that's on ones, like an arm or something. And I love those like rubbery fingers where, you know, you have like fingernails on there. Like, there's something really cool about that, you know.
I asked him how much those specials cost, and he said about a million a piece to do.
Back then?
In the 50s. That's what he said. He said he had a blank check to do whatever he wanted. And that was a lot of money. Because I think a feature like, what was it, 101 Dalmatians came in around maybe $4 million at the time, you know, which was still a lot of money. But to do $1 million for, it was a 45-minute show. So, you know. But it was shown everywhere. It was they got a lot of mileage on educational, you know, distributing to schools and stuff.
That's where I saw Toot Whistle first, was when I was in, I was like in second grade, and they showed it. And when the boom hits his stomach, I remember kids, they're going crazy laughing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It was fun. Like, especially with all the strings breaking, which.
Gosh, that stuff is awesome. That animation is cool.
It's really neat. It's really neat. So you used a lot of that kind of thinking in the Lost in Space piece, because did you use it more in the titles, like the, when it goes to the title, because you count down to the title, and the title is all color, all fully animated, and using it's almost like that could have been from one of those Man in Space shows, you know. There's a cool thing with the robot kind of dancing in there, but it's all silhouette. So very, very neat. If you're listening to this and you haven't seen this, it's cool. It starts off in storyboard, works into a little bit of animation, then finally goes into the title of the show with a countdown, and it's very exciting. Did it very well. Looks great.
Oh, thank you.
And I look at it, excites me. It gets me, you know, it pumps me up, and I'm like, wow, you know, this is pretty neat, you know. And I'm still surprised they never did it as a show, you know. What happened when you got it to the point where you could actually show somebody? Did it actually go to 20th Century to?
Yes, like I had done it, and again, like I can't remember what we had actually recorded, but like you and me, that did we talk about, like I had showed it at Rhythm and Hughes as I got further, because I was working on it while I was at Daryl's. Then I had gotten a little further working on it because then Renegade's work ran out and I had to go back to Rhythm and Hughes and I was animating on the next Scooby movie.
Oh.
And there's the first CG Scooby movie, CG live action.
Right.
And there's a lot of CalArts people there. And when I moved out here, like there was a lot of CalArts people at Rhythm and Hughes too. Like Glenn Ramos and Melanie Corden, and I hit it off with them immediately, because they knew who Frank and Ollie were. Like it was like this crazy, like, oh my God, you guys know what I'm talking about. Like they knew the Disney history. They knew, mm-hmm. you know, it was great. It was really kind of didn't feel as alone, you know, that no one in Chicago knew that stuff, but.
Well, that stuff makes you instant friends, especially, you know, if you're talking about Frank and Ollie. Oh, yeah. You know, I actually met one of them, you know. And
yeah, exactly. And they did, you know.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah, I met a lot of my heroes, you know. I never met Preston Blair, but I did. I had lunch with Ken Anderson and Dale Bear. I worked for Dale Bear on a couple of commercials, but Andreas was there. Just trying to think who else. It's just a number of people, all Disney, you know, they worked either Imagineering or they worked in animation. And so Jane Bear was there and just sitting there I went there with a very famous background artist who worked on a lot of the Hanna-Barbera stuff, but he worked on Sword and Stone and Sleeping Beauty, and that was Walt Purgoy. I worked with him at Don Bluth Studios, and I went over and I talked to him. We became friends, and he said, yeah, you know, I'm going to the Dinosaur Club in Burbank. Uh-huh. It was it used to be Alphonse. It's called Point of View, and he said, why don't you come with me? And we got into he had this giant Cadillac. It's like from the 60s. He's driving down. He was like 64 at the time. And I was like, you know, maybe 33 or 31. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so we went down there. It was kind of fun. So sat around this table of Disney legends, you know, very neat.
Yeah.
So did you pitch it to 20th Century on this?
Yeah, well, I went back to Rhythm and Hues, I showed it to some friends, and their response to it was so overwhelmingly like, whoa, like you have to show this to like whoever owns the rights. I was like, really? And they're like, yeah, like, oh my gosh, it's looking great. And I was like, I didn't even think about that, but. And then, so I knew because I had those CDs of the music of John Williams that were from Lost in Space, because I'm not sure if everyone listening knows that John Williams was from Star Wars and Jaws. Like, he was Johnny Williams, and his early career was doing stuff for Lost in Space.
Yeah, didn't he get a start on Lost in Space doing the Johnny?
Yeah, I think he did some things before that, but
yeah
that was. Definitely early on.
And he was credited as Johnny Williams.
Yeah.
A little credit on the show for this big theme. And
the music it's a part of the feel of the show, definitely. Like, they reuse that music all three seasons so much. Like, boy, it's the flavor of the show. Like, you know you're watching Lost in Space.
Oh, absolutely. I love that. I love that stuff. I love his first theme. I like the second theme that he did, which was more, I guess it was more modern.
Yeah.
But they were both great themes. They were just both great, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the first theme, I learned that later on because what blew my mind as part of like what helped me kind of stay with Lost Space, like what blew my mind was like they eventually in Chicago started showing the black and white episodes. And they had only shown the pilot, the first episode. And then once they started showing the other episodes, and you saw, whoa, this was serious? What? And you heard, oh, my God, the music is written for this, what I'm watching here, these themes I know. Like, here's the first time they're using it. It's he wrote it for this. Like,
right.
When the spaceship is crashing, he wrote that music for the, oh, my God, you know. it was just very exciting. I mean, I will also say that when I was in Chicago, like, they never showed the black and white episode. God, I'm gonna lose all friends, like, but they would never show black and white episodes. They would only show the color episodes, except for the pilot. And then one time in junior high, I'm like, I really want to see these, and I saw on the TV guide, oh, channel 32, here's the phone number, and I built up the courage. I called out, "Hi, can I?" And my voice is still high, but you know, then I was like, I want to know how come you don't show black and white episodes Lost in Space?" A lady, "Oh, hold on." She's very not must and knew I was a kid.
Right.
I hear like programming. And then they put me through. Like, "Hi, I was wanting to know why." And the lady at program was like, "But they're in black and white." Yeah. I'm like, "Yeah, but I don't think people will care. I don't. But the next year they started showing the black and white one. So I like to think that it's all because of me. I mean, it's not. But
I heard something that if somebody calls, they call in about something, they say that one call represents maybe 10,000 people that may not have called, you know.
In this case, no, it was just me.
It was one. Well, no, I'm just saying, you know, because it does, they say if somebody writes a letter, it actually means more because the person, you know, for somebody to write a letter, it takes a lot more effort. And so,
yeah.
Well, so maybe they had two people. Maybe you were the first, and then somebody else said, "Oh, maybe we should do this," you know.
Maybe.
Well, you know the story about Tom and Jerry, right?
No, which one?
It's okay. So Bill and Joe.
Oh, wait. I know the story where, yeah, one person, they weren't going to make anymore.
They weren't going to make anymore. They did the one, Puss Gets the Boot. It didn't even have a name for the characters. Yeah. And they did it, went over very well in the theaters, and an exhibitor, I think from Texas, wrote and said, "When are you going to make any more of those wonderful cat and mouse cartoons?" Yeah, so, you know, what's interesting is they would run those MGM cartoons. You know, they'd finish these cartoons, and they'd go into the studio theater, and everybody would kind of crowd in, and they would view the cartoon. And, but there would be people there that weren't even like really, they'd be involved, but they were in the process of ink and paint or shooting the thing, or they were technical people or whatever. They would watch the cartoon and they would get a reaction from the crowd, right?
Yeah.
And you would think that they would listen to that and they go, "Oh, I think we got a hit on our hands. Maybe we should show it to some, you know." Because Disney used to take all their cartoons and they would actually drive to a theater, like in Glendale, like the Alex Theater, and they'd run the cartoon and they would gauge the audience reaction. They did that with almost every film that came out, whether it was a short or a feature. And then they would know. They would know what they had, you know? Sometimes you don't know because you know the way it is. You're so close to it. And it's like me with, you know, working on that Warner Brothers stuff like Yakko's World. And, you know, the thing, basically, they knew they had a winner because I think they showed it to some of the Warner brass. And, I mean, when I saw it, I was like, I was surprised how good it was. But then other people were telling me how good it was. And then they decided to run it six months before the show came out. So, you know, they must have been doing tests on it. You know, so you would think that Quimby, people like Fred Quimby, would look at the cartoon and hear the audience reaction and go, "Oh, wow, I think we got something." And it's almost the same thing with your Lost in Space piece because, you know, you're getting this wonderful reaction from just people looking at, you know, not expecting anything, just watching and going, "Oh, wow, this is really good," you know?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So where did that go after that?
People were telling me, they liked it a lot. Uh-huh. And then they're like, you should get a hold of people who have control of it. So I knew on those CDs that I was just talking about, like I saw on the back, like executive producer, Kevin Burns.
Okay.
And there were liner notes inside. Well, I thoroughly read them.
I'm sure.
And it said like how Kevin came upon like finding these reels, like it's all Kevin Burns,
right?
I think like in Starlog or someplace, I knew he was the person who found the robot when the robot was in storage and the robot was actually destroyed from being used on another show. He was spray painted white and the robot restored and fixed and he there he was on this Lost in Space Forever. at the end of it, they recreated, they had, because Kevin had a chance to do this because the movie came out and he had to promote the old show, where they got Jonathan Harris and Bill Mumy and Robot. They had them all there and they recreated the Jupiter 2, like the interior, and they filmed new stuff of them.
Right. And I saw it, by the way.
And they have a making of it on the DVD. Yeah. And on the making of it, you saw there. Oh, this guy, this is Kevin Burns. This guy, he's the key. He is the key to all of it. He's the key. And I at the time, you can go on Internet Movie Database. If you went to Pro, you can find, I don't think you can do it anymore, you can find someone's information.
Oh, wow.
I paid this money and I looked him up, like, okay, if I send it here, this is the address that says for, it's just an absolutely cold call, right? Like, mm-hmm. If I send it to this place, it was Synthesis Entertainment, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It was like care of this just lot, whatever, there's the box, 20th Century Fox lot. So I had one of my tapes, made a copy of it, and I wrote this letter, like, hey, I'm a huge fan of Lost in Space. I just did this for myself. A lot of people have been responding to it, so figured I'd show you, see what you think, and hope you like it, you know?
Right.
I sent it, and then I didn't hear anything for 6 months. And I was like, well, you know, I gave it a shot. And now, you know, right now I have an agent and all that stuff.
Right.
I mean, I was so naive to how it all worked. Like, I didn't even know, like, how do you even pitch a show? I knew I was coming in, like, not knowing anything,
right.
You know? I have this vendor, a thorough vendor background where you get these shots, including Rhythm and Hues, where we would get from Warner. You get these shots from a mysterious place, and you do these shots, and you animate, it's all good, you know?
Right.
You get praise or maybe not, you know? So this was all new to me. I just, like, cold sent this video to, you know, I didn't hear anything from 6 months. And then one day I was home and I got this phone call. And by that time, I got this new apartment where I made it all mid-century modern, because while making Lost in Space, I was like, okay, I want to be influenced by everything that came before Lost in Space. So I learned about 64 World's Fair.
Right.
And all this stuff. And I'm like, I'm gonna surround myself with all this stuff. So I got all this. I answered it with this, like, rotary phone I bought, right?
Right.
it was all blue. And hello. Like, hello, is this Scott O'Brien? I'm like, yeah, speaking. And like, we have Kevin Burns on the line. Hold on. I'm like, okay. And I mean, I'm a naive kid, right? Like, right. In my heart, like, me, it was like,
oh, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, what's this guy? And then he's like, Scott O'Brien. I'm like, hi. And he's like, Scott O'Brien, my hero. I'm like, what? And that's how he started, you know? And he was like, yeah, we want to bring you in. I loved it. I love what you did. We want to bring you in. We want you to meet everybody. God, yeah. I was like, all right, you know, I was shaking. Boy, when I hung up the phone.
Where'd you have to go to meet him?
It was at 20th Century Fox. It was at the lot. They had a trailer inside the lot.
Oh, okay.
So I went there, and I lived 5 minutes away. I didn't even realize it. Like, I was like it's crazy. Like, it was like West LA. And 20th Century Fox was just a little bit over. So I was like, oh, shit. I didn't realize I was this. It was like past the 10. It was just a little bit over. It was pretty close.
Right.
You know? So I drove over there. And I drive on the lot. I never driven on any studio lot before.
Wow.
God. Like, yeah. I was so naive. And I go in there. I drive in there. I park my car. And there's a trailer. And there's a girl in there. And I was like, hi, I'm here to see Kevin Burns. And she's like, oh, have a seat right there. You know, Kev will be back in a second. Like, okay. And I was like, I was single at the time. I was like, oh, maybe, well, she's pretty. And then she asked me something about, hey, do I know how to get Lakers tickets? And I was like, no. And I was like, okay, well, this is a done deal because I know nothing about sports, so forget it.
Right.
And then Kevin came in, and again, he goes, is this Scott O'Brien, Scott O'Brien, my hero, again, right? He shook my hand. He's like, all right, this is my partner. Can't remember his name. So if he's listening, I apologize.
Right.
And then he goes to the girl behind the desk, like, here. And he had these sheets. He goes, here, check out these pictures of your mom. And he goes, Angela Cartwright's daughter. All right, come into my office. And I was like, holy fuck. And I stood up and I was like kind of losing it, but then I turned around. I didn't realize it, but there was like a full wall photograph blown up of the cast of Lost in Space. Like, there's this picture they took for Mad Magazine where they're making all these faces, like, you know, right, like little standouts. And I mean, him first saying that this is Angela Cartwright's daughter, and then me turn around seeing that and looking in there and seeing it, I was like, cookie jar of the robot. And I was like, the fact that this was Lost in Space Central,
right,
you know, was like, I was dead quiet. Like, I didn't say, it was just too much for my little, at that point, my mind to comprehend. Like, I was, like it was, and then he's like, hold on, let me get Billy here. Calls up Bill Mooney. Bill Mooney comes over.
Wow.
He's like, hold on. I have somebody else I want you to talk to. He calls up like Irwin Allen's widow. and she was a Viking in one of the episodes. Like, hey, this is, so I have Scott O'Brien here. And she's like, oh, hey. It was insanity.
Wow.
Wasn't standing, and then he watched it in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the opening titles weren't. I didn't do that animation of them floating through space yet.
Right.
He was like, you hear him reacting, like laughing and loving it.
Right.
Yeah, he was behind it. He was like, all right, like this is it. This is Lost in Space. Like, when they made that movie, it was whatever, and there was this other John Woo pilot that they had done that fell through. He's like, but you're taking it. This is like, you're saying this is Lost in Space. This is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I love. This is what you're presenting here. And yeah, I love it. This is what I want, you know?
Right.
And it was crazy. It was crazy.
Wow. Well, that had to be wonderful just to get that kind of praise on this thing.
From the people who mattered, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then you discovered, oh, there's other people actually like this, you know.
It was really, and since then, you know, of course, I'm like, you know, now I know more the ways of the industry and how it works and
sure,
how to pitch stuff and how things go through, but yeah, at that point, like, yeah, it was so early in my career that I was just, yeah, there was no, it had succeeded, like, further than I could have dreamed, you know?
Sure.
It, especially, like, this thing that I loved, yeah, but where I was, like, the annoying Lost in Space kid, like, growing up, where the Sandman obsessed with to get this response was just, holy crap. Oh,
tremendous, yeah. No, it's very neat.
Yeah.
So what happened from there? Did he propose anything about pitching an animated series with your animatic, or?
He kept on asking me if I can finish it. And I was like, because he's like, the way you did it is brilliant. Like, you have these storyboards and you have the rough animation, then you have some cleanup animation. And the cleanup, I had my friend Charlie Warren,
mm-hmm,
who I knew from Character Builders. I had shipped those scenes to him,
right,
old school way, and I paid him like probably like $2,000 or something. So those scenes that are cleaned up in there, and for the character animation,
sure.
If I could finish the end animation of them going through space, and that I was doing with, I didn't really know Flash, but I knew enough to kind of I was learning it because of that. Like, I can learn how to do rigs.
Sure.
You know?
Right.
I wanted to be like pieces. Like, the Catch Me If You Can titles came out eventually. And I was like, oh, look at that, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was, I worked on that. I finished it. And I showed Kevin. He's like, oh, oh. And he was from New York, you know? Like, he was his actors are so funny.
Right.
And then he was like, I started working on Puffy on Me. Then there, all that stuff was happening, you know, at the same time as, you know, Daryl starting to expand, and then they got the Puffy Amiyumi show, and then they moved to Glendale.
Right.
And then my episodes were going over pretty good then when the show first came out. I'm not sure how much Sam registered like my stuff as I got, and I learned more. Mm-hmm. He seemed like what I was more through the early stuff. And I was like, hey, Sam, I know I have a pilot for Lost in Space. Would you take a look at it? He was running Cartoon Network at the time.
Right.
Like, yeah, come on over. So I got Kevin, and we went there. We went to Cartoon Network. And they showed it to Sam,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Sam was like, all right, well, you know, every studio that goes to show animation, the way it works, and it was all vague in my mind, but basically it was like the way animation works was that every studio that shows animation is going to want to own it outright, own the property outright.
Mm-hmm.
So our options were limited to where we could show it, because Kevin wasn't going to sell the rights. And Sam was like, but, you know, this here, you know, I kids don't like retro either. And we don't, but I feel like we could have some sort of parody of it and have it on Adult Swim. And Kevin said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And there's a fight. Sam was mad.
Was there blood?
That Kevin was mad. And I know Kevin was like, grab the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And then he left.
Right.
And I was like, what the hell just happened? And it was basically just that Star Wars was one thing because they had Clone Wars. Cartoon Network showed Clone Wars, but because it was Star Wars and that property is like so popular that.
Yeah.
But then it was like, yeah, the opportunities to sell it to any place to show were very limited and ended up being like it could only be then Fox, and Fox only had their adult stuff, and Kevin didn't want to do that. So it kind of fell apart.
It is it's crazy to me because everybody's trying to shoehorn it into, you know, what their vision of what something is, and, you know, well, this will never play because, you know, the kids won't like it. And, you know, they don't like retro. They don't like horses. They don't like chariots,
right.
You know.
Right.
It's all these different reasons. It's like, why don't you just look at it? Did you like it? You know, did you legitimately like it? Instead of just trying to figure out, oh, well, you know, and then, you know, why don't you test it in front of a bunch of kids? Why don't you bring in a group of kids, have them sit down, watch it, and see what they think of it, you know?
Right.
Let them tell you. Yeah.
One of the things he said, because he had his hands back like this, like, all right, well, you know, I love it, but am I responding to it because of the nostalgia factor, or am I responding to it because of it, like, a new idea? And I think I'm responding to it because of the nostalgia factor, and nostalgia doesn't sell. And then that was it, you know?
Right. Yeah. And he's trying to fit into boxes, you know?
Yeah.
Which is never a good thing. And I don't think it was nostalgia factor. When I saw it, it felt very fresh to me, you know? It felt different. It felt, you know, and it was still, but what was really crazy was the fact that the orchestrations, John Williams orchestrations, should make it very modern, because that stuff it plays today. It doesn't sound like a 60s cartoon. It doesn't sound like a 60s TV show. the music of that. Yeah, there is some there's some nostalgic thing with me, but when I was watching it, I just felt like this was a brand new, fresh take on it, and the acting and the character designs for it and stuff just made it a lot of fun, you know, and the title sequence is a lot of fun. So, you know, I don't think retro doesn't sell. I think that's just, you know, just the ideas that people have in their head. Like, you know, there's a show called Beanie and Cecil where I don't think it could play today, you know, the way it was back in the 60s. It is really a show from the time period. I think it appears very dated, but with this thing, it just seems so fresh. So I don't know. I think they didn't even give it a shot. They should have given, you know, if he liked it, he should have said, I like it. Let's see what we could do with it. Let's test it in front of a bunch of kids or whatever. And then let's just do a pilot. Let's do a special. Do one shot.
Well, I think also what was working against it was just the ownership, you know, that this is property. No one wants to share, right?
Right.
I mean, now it's been on Netflix. So I'm not sure what has changed since then, but it's like, that was also like playing into it where it was like, you know, what do we do with it? But I agree with you. Like, I don't think it's, I would prefer to if like kids didn't know about the original series where it's like, I think it's just super relatable. And I think always has been where it's like, you know, when Lost in Space was first on, like, let's say like not even syndication, when it was first on, like its worst ratings were better than Star Trek's best ratings. Right.
Right.
And that's like huge. That's like such a huge thing. And I think it's because it's just like, it's this relatable family. Everyone has these tropes that, you know, that people can relate to. It's not too embedded in sci-fi.
Right.
And I feel like it's still true today where it's like this family with all these kind of, you know, character personalities together, working together. And I think that's all timeless. It just, you know, it has nothing to do with it being retro. It's just this kind of fun little adventure that this family goes on. And one guy is obviously, you know, being a jerk, and kids could easily see this guy, the jerk of the, you know.
Right.
It's very cool. I think it's very cool. And it's like an evergreen property, I feel.
Right.
But what do I know? You know.
Apparently a lot more than some of the people running these networks.
I guess so.
No, it's I think it's excellent. And that's why I put it on the Facebook page, because I was like, this needs to be seen. It's really good. And I know a lot of people have seen it on YouTube, but you know, I just want to call attention to it again. So
I don't even know that person who put it up, by the way. Like, because then Kevin put it on the Blu-ray set. So then it was there, like then people can get it, right? It was added to put it on the Blu-ray Lost in Space thing.
Uh-huh.
So then somebody took it and ripped it and put it on YouTube. Like, I have no idea who that person is, but
yeah,
they have whatever 58,000 views.
Well, they mention your name on it. They mention your name in the notes. So it was like,
yeah, that's nice.
I gotta check out this guy, find out what he's doing, because it's just like I said, I was amazed and delighted. So I'm one of the fans. So there you go.
No, thank you.
There you go. Who animated it? You got a couple of people animate on that thing. That was Burke Klein and Bill Waldman.
Yeah, once I was at, you know, once they saw Burke Klein and. Well, when they came to Renegade to do a commercial, Burke Klein came in there and his friend Bill Waldman. And Bill Waldman, I heard, was a huge Lost in Space fan, that he dressed like the buff. There's one episode that Lost in Space, where Dr. Smith gets all buff.
Oh, that's right.
And they all dress like him for Halloween one year. So he was a huge mega fan. I was like, oh, look what I did. And they were both like, ooh, 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 well. And then Bert was like, well, I want to do a scene. And Bill was like, yeah, I'll do one too. And yeah, they both, Bert did the scene of like, why did they leave the chariot so far away? Like that. And Bill did one with Dr. Smith walking up to the robot where he's like, you, sir, come with me. And Burns was added
right
to the doc bills. I still had to. It was a complicated shot where there was a pan over, and then it revealed that Dr. Smith, the kids in the background, that Dr. Smith had to walk in the distance.
Right,
I would do that. So I never got around to it because by that time I had gotten married and started to have a family, and then time became more precious.
You know? More precious, yeah. There's a project that there was an attraction at Disneyland called America Sings.
Yeah.
And James Lopez, who I guess he really liked the attraction, he took the soundtrack and he started animating pieces of it. Because it was an animatronic show at Disneyland that's now defunct. But the soundtrack plays really well. If you listen to the soundtrack, it's kind of fun to listen to. And so he animated a bunch of stuff from that show in, it looks like something out of Robin Hood, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's that technique, how they were, you know, it's classical animation, but that align technique that was kind of rough. And so he did a bunch of scenes and then put it in with the storyboards and stuff, and it played really well. And it's another one that I think that they should actually just make as a film, but they never will. Uh-huh. They never will. Because
Because I know Jamie, and I had seen that, and he's feeling my exact pain, where it's like when you do something that you don't own, you know, there's that risk where, you know, because luckily I was doing it for because I loved it in the first place. So I don't feel I already achieved a goal further than I had ever thought.
Sure.
But you actually are doing something with an established property and you are hoping for something else to happen with it.
Right. I know. I know.
Don't get your hopes up.
Can't do anything with it, you know, unless they want to do something with it. So
yeah, they have to come to you pretty much.
Like, exactly.
So.
But, you know, I'm sure you learned a lot from that. And then,
I learned. I mean, it really helped me to understand even just the of Hollywood, like how Hollywood works, that whole experience, you know, even though I wasn't probably as vocal or by thoughts organized as well as I wanted to at the time, it was going through that whole thing and experiencing it and just really kind of giving me, you know, showing me how everything works and, you know, there's all the positivity that could happen of like meeting people who you look up to. It's they don't have to be jerks either. Kevin was, you know, he was always amazing to me. He was always, he always invited me over, you know,
right.
Passed away years ago, which is, you know, sad. You know, he was a good guy. He was really cool.
Sorry. You wonder sometimes how a show like SpongeBob SquarePants gets through, you know, how that, because it's like, it's not hitting any buttons. It's kind of like, it's weird. And yet somebody said, that's the show, you know, that's the show that's going to last for 20 years on the air or more, you know, and you kind of wonder why. What was that?
I don't think they knew it, you know,
no.
Where I thought like it came out at first and I don't think it was a huge hit right away. I just know after a while, I was like, whoa, it's like really picked up. And I never would have guessed. Like when I saw it, the first time I saw it, it was like because Daryl had a commercial for Target and it was SpongeBob. He wanted SpongeBob in the commercial.
Mm-hmm.
So Nickelodeon had sent over a VHS copy of it. And I watched, you know, so I knew like how I could fit in. I watched it. I mean, my first reaction was like, what the hell? Like it was breaking all these rules that you learn not to do in Illusion of Life. Like no parallel lines.
Right.
And then you see like they're doing it on purpose. Like,
yeah.
It was like my first time kind of dealing with that stuff. But it was also like, well, this is okay. It's like kind of like, I don't know, like a toned down version of SpongeBob or of Ren and Stimpy. Like the humor is kind of like Ren and Stimpy. It's kind of like that. So
yeah, but pretty much in the way the storyboards are played. Like, wait, what's that? I'm sorry.
People love it now, though. You know, it's like
Yeah, it's like a, you know, I know when I pitched a couple of shows and they would always ask about the backstory. Like, you know, I would go through a pitch and they would say, well, you know, it could have been about a monkey. So they'll go, so the monkey can talk? He said, yes, the monkey can talk. And it's like, well, why does the monkey talk? And I mean, if you went to pitch something like Bugs Bunny today, it would just be like a mass of confusion. No, be like, I know. Why does he walk? You know, aren't bunnies, don't they hop? And, you know, I can imagine all the little questions that they'd be asking. Why does he say, what's up, Doc? I don't understand, you know. And
logically, yeah.
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 Yeah. But, you know, hey, it played for a long time and people loved it. So,
I mean, back then it was like they just, because studios felt like they needed an animation department because of Disney. And they didn't quite, well, all right, we have this. All right, go ahead, do whatever. You know, because they didn't care.
Right.
You know, so everything got, all right, I have an idea about, you know.
Well, they were filler.
Like Roadrunner Coyote, you know, let's try this.
Yeah.
You know?
And they would just do it.
No way.
Yeah. They would just do it. They would not put the money behind anything today, you know?
Yeah.
So when you're done with Daryl Van Sitters, where'd you go after that? You're working on...
after that, like, there was a downturn in 2008. There was a downturn in 2008. So then, you know, Renegade actually downsized for a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I was out of work. I went back to Rhythm and Hues for a little bit to work on this thing called, I think it used to be called They Came From Upstairs, but they changed it to Aliens in the Attic.
Yeah.
And but at the same time, I had this thing that, my friend Chris Sonnenberg was at DreamWorks and they were doing this thing for this 2D thing. For Kung Fu Panda, the direct yes. DVD.
Right, right.
Furious 5, something. And he gave me a bunch of scenes in that. Which one thing became a meme. My kids told me, like, one of my scenes where is this turtle, it's a turtle, like, he's like, monkey. Like, it became a meme. And my kids told me that. Because they had shown me, I'm like, oh, I animated that. And they were like, what? You know, like, you never know what's going to become a meme.
Right.
And then after that, I got contacted at Disney to board on this TV show called Kick Buttowski. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Bert Klein was like, oh, why don't you try to get on Princess and the Frog? And Jamie was like that too.
Right.
That was the only 2D game in town in the world. And I was like, if I go there, I submitted my stuff. They're like, oh, we like it a lot, but it's a little too cartoony for this project. And Bert was like, no, it's not. Put on this stuff. And because he really was familiar with my work at that point.
Sure.
Put on this, and you'll be able to get on here with us, you know? And I just kind of thought it through where I felt. And again, this is like looking to the future. It's like when I chose to do CG, right? Mm-hmm. I'm looking to the future. I felt like I'm not that great at storyboarding. And 2D, I always love to do. I'm confident in it. But if I attempt to get on this Prince and the Frog thing, with everyone in all the A-listers in the world trying to be on this and getting on this thing, I'm going to get, crowd shots? We get all these shit shots.
Right.
And then they were going to train me at Disney TV to do this, you know, boarding for TV. And that's going to be my future more. So I chose, like, I think I'm going to try this Kick Buttowski TV thing. And Bert, I don't think he was that happy. Like, he was, what? Right. Like, how could I possibly decide to do this?
Yeah.
TV, yeah, what?
You know, I think you're correct in your thinking, you know, but everybody makes their decisions based off of one thing or another. I think you probably would have liked to go and do the hand-drawn stuff, but I think you were also in the mindset that, you know, where is this going to lead, you know?
Right.
And a lot of people just go with their heart and just do the one thing, but you just felt like, well, if I do this, I'm learning something and then it's going to propel me to do other things. And maybe this is the way I should go. And I, you know, there's no right decision in life. You know, everybody makes, right. I had an offer for two jobs in storyboard, and one, it was like a shoo-in. They wanted me like yesterday, and it was in New York, and so it would have just been, you know, I just would have went there and just started working on the thing, and it would have been great. But the other thing that I was offered was Woody Woodpecker, and I loved Woody Woodpecker, and I wanted to work on that more. And it was just and that was long distance. That was by mail. And that got all screwed up. There were problems with the script. They were sending me parts of the script, not the whole script. And there was a miscommunication. I ended up working on Woody Woodpecker for like 2 weeks. And, then I was let go because of some it was really something crazy because I never received like the last part of the script. And there was, like I said, there was a misunderstanding, and then basically that was it. I was done. But if I stayed in New York, you know, so, you know, that's the decision. That was the choice. Door number one or door number two. Door number right. two is a clunk. Door number one is the one I probably should have went through, but sometimes that happens in life. So,
right.
Yeah. So,
and I feel like ultimately for me, it was like, I probably couldn't have made a better choice because I did feel like I needed to improve with boarding. And when I went there, it's like it forced me into, because it wasn't as easy to pick up as animation was, where it was like, oh, this is something I've always been interested in. Like from all my life, this was like something where it was harder to kind of learn story structure and learn what made a good board.
Right.
And even how to draw for boards where, because the first season of Kick, I was drawing like still like an animator where you do like the construction and do this and that.
Sure.
And boy, I was taking forever. And my stuff, you know, went over okay with execs and, you know, it was fine. But I told this before too, where that in between seasons, they kept me over and they put me they asked if I want to stay on this other show called Fishhooks.
Okay.
Or as a, they called it a continuity something, but I was basically kind of doing revisions to make sure things were all, you know, they were having problems.
Right.
But they were going to pay me my same rate for 6 months. I was like, sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on there and I saw that their stuff was way more rough, but I liked it more than mine. Like I liked it way more than mine.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it way more than mine. And I was watching it like, how are they doing this? Like they were drawing in ways like drawing like the eyes and mouth first and the contour of the shape around it. Mm-hmm. Like after, like, what? How are they doing this? But I loved it. And I thought their stuff was really alive. Like I felt like those characters are alive.
Mm-hmm.
Then when it came time for me to go back to Kick Vitalski, I'm like, all right, there's going to be some changes. Right.
Right.
Then I did it that way. Right. Mm-hmm. And God, I mean, then that is when I really started to get it. And my boards became more character driven where, you know, like the character was pulling you through the story and having you choose like what, you know, angles to use instead of me just thinking about like, oh, I have to draw this background. Like what the character's feeling is really, it's doing everything. What do you want to see next? And then I started flowing, but it changed my life. And then I was like, then the executive started to really like my stuff. And I just bought a house. So I was broke. And they were like, my stuff was going over so good that they were having me double up on storyboards and they were paying me, you know, so I could get this extra money. But it really had changed my life in terms of like understanding, having a thorough understanding of story, why things work, and dealing with the executives and what they were looking for, you know, mm-hmm. it really was a big deal for me, you know?
Wow. So. So where'd you move on from there with the, when you picked that up and you were starting to do that, did that open up your horizons with other projects?
Well, I mean, Disney still always wanted me there. But I had, after that, I went on to, they had me do something. They, you know, like, if you're starting to go to another show, it's almost like you're starting from scratch. So they have me like, hey, you want to be on Minnie's Boutique for a little bit? I was like, I guess. Yeah, but then my friend Peggy Reagan, who I mentioned before,
yes,
she was a line producer on Teen Titans Go, mm-hmm, where I knew a lot of people from. Puffy AmiYumi, like, hey, you want to come over here and direct? I was like, sure. I quit. I went over there.
Right.
That was, God, the schedule was crazy.
Yeah.
Daryl got a Tom and Jerry show, and he was coming to me to board some things sometimes. So I did that a few times. And Teen Titans Go was so crazy, I decided to quit there. And then I wanted to get back to Disney because the executives love my stuff.
Right.
So I went to Disney to work on Star and the Forces of Evil because I saw that, well, this looks like it's kind of like anime, kind of like I Dream a Genie.
Yeah.
And I could do my thing. The way the character was designed was like a way I could draw real well. And they had directors that were brought over from Kung Fu Panda series, and they wanted it like cinematic, but it was a Harmony show.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this should be, and I was a board artist on that. I was like, I don't know. Like, how are you guys going to have the animators do this? They're like, I don't know. And then they wanted it more cinematic. I was like, I didn't want to do it. And then eventually I got fired from there. I went to this Nickelodeon then to go on. Now these are just random stories. I went to Nickelodeon to work on this preschool show called Shimmer and Shine. It was 2D. And they like my stuff, but then they went to 3D.
Right.
And I said, I quit. And then I went to Disney again.
I gotta stop you. Cause I think it's funny because, you know, sometimes you get into a groove in a show and everybody likes what you're doing. And then all of a sudden somebody else comes along and they don't like what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then you get axed just because it's that one person coming in and they're saying, no, I don't like anything he's doing. No, he doesn't work for the show.
Yeah. Yes. That happens. Yeah.
It happens all the time. And it's all subjective. It's just really weird. Sometimes it's just a personality thing. Sometimes they meet you and they go, yeah, I don't like this guy.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
It's so idiotic. The guy has been doing wonderful work all his time, and then all of a sudden he's a piece of crap, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's unfortunately it happens. It happens a lot. And I understand wanting to leave a show because you might be in a groove and then you go into this place and nothing is working for you. And you're just like, and it really becomes just work, right?
Yep.
It's just like, you hate doing it. It's like, oh God, you know, just somebody call me and get me off this show, you know?
Yeah.
So I totally understand. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but go.
Well, you learn to look for warning signs like, uh-oh, I see what's happening. I'm about to get fired. All right, I got to get out of here first,
right,
you know?
Right, nobody wants to be fired. But
yeah.
But like I said, it's not because you weren't good at what you were doing. It's just that somebody came in and they may not like the way you're doing. They may not like the way you look. They may not like the way you dress. They may not like the roast beef sandwich you're eating that day.
Yeah.
You know, who knows?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it does happen. So doesn't mean anything. So
Nope.
So go on.
That takes a while to figure out too. You know, like it's like you have to kind of go through it like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? But after a while, it's like, I don't know.
Well, sometimes getting fired is a good thing. You know, sometimes it leads you to go places where you probably would not normally have gone. And might turn into a really good experience. I'm sure it's happened.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Okay. So, so you're looking to get back to Disney again.
Yeah. But every time I got back, I couldn't get back to the same executives where it's like that. Like I couldn't get over that hump where I know if I get myself in front of them,
right,
be okay. But would be like all right, these other people on top of me that, all right, we're going to pitch your stuff that you board. And before they would pitch it, they change the hell out of it. And it's like,
wow.
That's not anymore.
Crazy.
You know, like you couldn't just get it. You couldn't get your stuff in front of them sometimes.
Right. No, I know how that goes. So, where'd you go from there?
I worked on this Future Worm show. That didn't go that good either. That was more of like one of those shows that was like, you know, ugly on purpose type show.
Right.
And it wasn't my character kind of heartfelt stuff that I tend to want to do, like a heartfelt comedy that's still.
Do you like those shows? You know, it seems to be the thing. It's like, you know, you used to be drawing with appeal, making something look good, make it, you know. And then all of a sudden, it's like these shows have come along where it just seems like it's they're just creating a design, and it could be the ugliest thing on earth. And but somebody like goes, yeah. You know, let's do really ugly so people don't want to watch it, you know?
I mean, it seems fine. I mean, a lot of adult shows go that route, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever.
I think you could do adult and still make it look good, you know?
But yeah.
I don't know.
My favorite adult show is, I love what Gendy did with Primal. I thought that thing looked great. Like, that was the way to do limited animation. Like, Well, I guess that dinosaur, like, with, you know, anticipation, like screaming with each one is an awesomely drawn pose.
Right.
That thing is top notch. So good.
Wow. What? It was Primal? That was the name of it?
Primal. Yeah. Check that out. That's cool.
Where was that on? Netflix or?
No, it was on, I saw it on HBO Max. So I'm not sure where it's on.
Right.
No, it may have to still be on there. Yeah.
It's possible it's made its way somewhere else. Well, we'll check it out.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a cool show.
How many times how many times have you worked with Gendy?
Just that one time. Just that one time on recently on Fixed.
Wow.
His sensibility, I always liked Dexter's Lab and you know that stuff. So I figure like, when I work with him, I think I should be able to hit it off with him.
Right.
And I doubt he remembers my name, but you know, I enjoy working with him and he liked my shots, you know.
I heard stuff he was doing on the Popeye movie was interesting. I think that was CG though, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I think Popeye falls into the category of Lost in Space or these other things where it's a property where, you know, everyone wants to. This is what kids want. This is what kids want, you know? Right. So you can't really get away with just doing what you know is right.
Right.
You know?
So what are you working on now? Are you loving it? What is it?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I'm boarding on this, the offshoot of The Loud House. It's unannounced, so can't say too much about it, but it's a lot of fun to work on and having a good time.
Okay. Really cool. Scott, thank you for coming on here and talking about your career a little bit. And you still having fun?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the future is always a little scary, you know. we'll see, you know.
Yeah. Well, maybe pursue the Lost in Space thing again. Maybe you can get that happening.
I was thinking about it. I mean, now that Disney and, you know, Disney and Fox have merged.
That's right.
Like with Disney bought Fox, so... I don't know. We'll see.
You never know. They may put it on FX or they may put it on Disney Plus or Disney Channel. I don't even know if that still exists.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, with streaming, it's like, I guess that's a big thing where with streaming, no one's really figured it out. Like, where are things going to be the most successful and how to do it? So it's still like almost like the Wild West in a way.
It is. Know? It is. I think they're pulling back on some stuff, though, but I think you're right. I think they're still trying to figure it out and how to monetize it and do stuff. But maybe even pitch it as a special. Pitch Lost in Space as a one-time. They'll do it for streaming. You know, they'll do a one-shot. And then, I don't know, maybe you can make it a Christmas special or something where you put some Christmas trees on Jupiter or something. I don't know.
Well, if someone does a crappy enough Lost in Space thing, maybe I'll get pissed off enough to just like do it myself with this new technology and get it done. By the way, I should mention that for everyone listening, to check out Zoki of Planet Ruby on Amazon. that was just kind of dumped there by Nickelodeon, then it's a great show. It's really sweet. It has a lot of heart.
And is this CG or traditional? Is this traditional or CG? It's all CG.
It's a Harmony show. It's a Harmony show. So it's 2D.
Oh, very neat.
And yeah, it's Brian Moranti's show. And I was supervising director. Well, I was called supervising producer, but really supervising director.
Director for, on the show.
Or, you know.
Okay, so, what's the name of it again? It's Soki?
Soki of Planet Ruby.
Cool.
On Amazon.
Cool. Thanks for coming on here. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, Brian.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Hey, wasn't that a whole lot of fun? That was Scott O'Brien, and a wonderful talent in the animation business. So thank you, Scott, for coming on and spending your time with us. You know, when we do these podcasts, you know, we've had a couple of three-parter episodes. And, you know, I actually try to keep them down to about two parts. And the reason why we do that is basically, you know, I understand sometimes an interview may go a little bit too long, but sometimes there's such good stuff there that it needs to be three episodes. So, like I said, I try to keep it down to two. Sometimes it's just one episode, and sometimes it goes to three, and that's just the nature of things. Anyway, if you really like what you're listening to, please subscribe. Go to your favorite service. Click on the subscribe button. Click on the subscribe button. Why don't you? And this way you'll be notified every time a brand spanking new Cartoonerific Classic Animated Cartoons podcast is uploaded for your listening pleasure. And if you really like what you're listening to, please tell a friend. Just give them a call. Tell them about the Cartoonerific podcast. And hopefully they'll join us. Anyway, I want everybody to have a great day. I want you to have an excellent week. And thank you again for tuning in.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.